This program was recorded in 1982.
What were these men doing? They were making millions of dollars selling CIA terrorist equipment, expertise, and actually training Libyans, selling this equipment to Libya, and actually training terrorists in the Libyan China Lake terrorist training camp. Now, as the story is being squeezed out in bits and pieces, it's coming out, it's now been documented that there were active duty special forces officers helping them to train terrorists inside Libya. Now we're talking about up until 78, 79. And there were also CIA active duty personnel at China Lake training terrorists. And this even boggles my mind, having been inside and from what I've seen. But all of the to-do we're making about terrorism, and here we are, here our CIA is delivering technology and actually training Libyan terrorists.
Another fascinating evening with former CIA official John Stockwell, tonight on Alternative Views. Back in 1981, we did a program with John Stockwell called CIA Update. Well, it's no longer all that current, but, well, maybe it is. There are a lot of things that we talked about in that program that you still would be fascinated by. So we're going to see that again and present a new CIA story from 1986. John Stockwell is one of our good friends and a firm fixture on Alternative Views. I'm sure you know John by now. He was a former CIA high official for 12 years, quit the CIA and wrote a very famous informative book, In Search of Enemies. Well, he's a full-time writer now, and he is on his novel writing experience, and one is just coming out. John, what's the name of it and what's it about?
Well, my second book is Red Sunset. It's a story about some American oil company people in a small African capital, about the woman principally, and the adventures she gets into, which includes a chess match, a love story, a terrorist kidnap attempt, which is the vehicle. But really the purpose of writing the book was to try to discuss what it's like. Our enemies, our detractors, accuse us of being imperialists and being involved in neocolonialism. And it's always fascinated me because I've lived the life that they call neocolonialist, of in the big villa in a newly independent country with several servants and shiny new cars and jet planes here and there, while most of the people in the country have very little to survive, to live off of. And so this is the story. I wanted to write a story about ordinary Americans who live that kind of a life and what the life is all about, and how it affects the people around them as well as themselves.
And where does it take place? What are the actual scenes and characters and actions?
I set it in Burundi, and I chose Burundi because it's
in Africa.
Burundi is in. I chose it because it's exactly in the center of Africa. It's as close to nowhere, so to speak, as you can get. It's also a very pretty place. It's right on the Western Rift Valley, right at the northern tip of Lake Tanganyika. And you have the Mutumba Mountains and the Virunga volcanoes and the Lake Tanganyika. And the city is actually up overlooking the lake. So it's a gorgeous little place. And as I say, quite remote.
Well, you grew up in Africa.
Well, I grew up in Zaire, which is right across on the other side of the lake. And then I served in Zaire with the CIA. These Mutumba Mountains that I write about in this book were a haven of rebels when I was in Zaire, but I also served in Burundi at one time. So we had problems with the mountains were sort of an intelligence target, so we were covering them. I was sending people into the mountains, and I became fascinated with them. In fact, there were no viable rebels there. There was a great exaggeration of the rebel threat, because that's a good way to keep the United States and its aid interested in supporting your country. And I try to bring this out. There was a kidnapped threat that was brought to us from people across the lake who came into Burundi and said that they had information of a plot to kidnap the American ambassador. And this, of course, stirred us up no end, as you can imagine, flash cables to Washington and on a full-time alert and every security measure we could take. It turned out it was just a con. There was just some guys who wanted to squeeze a little money, a couple hundred dollars out of us. But then I was there in 70, 71 about when I left. But in 75, these same people did kidnap four European scholars working with a Caltech grant who were studying fish or something on the lake, and they did kidnap them and take them into the mountains. And so naturally, writing a novel about that area, I wanted to incorporate how, you know, how a kidnap plot could work and what kind of people would do it and how it would affect the people in the city itself.
Do you mostly focus on the African political situation or the sort of machinations between America and the Soviet Union behind the scenes, or did both of these themes come out?
Those themes are in the background. I wanted to focus on the life of an American woman who finds herself in such a place. And there is a Soviet diplomat involved. She plays a big chess match against the local chess master, who's a South African banker. And some of their friends are British. And the Africans are in the background. They're subplot, sort of, in the background, which some of the reviewers have said is, in a way, an ironic way, the strongest part of the book is the Africans in the background. But I really wanted the story to be about this young woman, not about politics or diplomacy so much as just her life.
So there's an element of the love story in that as well as a political novel. You're trying to combine these themes.
It started out to be more of a political intrigue novel, adventure intrigue in real life politics. And what happened was the love story took over the book. It was a subplot originally, and then by the time I got the manuscript in New York and sold it, the editors wanted me to focus on the woman and the love story. And essentially they persuaded me, and so it is primarily a love story, yes.
Well, John, you've been prohibited by the courts now to say anything or write anything about the CIA and its operations.
No, that's not exactly correct.
Exactly right.
No. I can say all kinds of things about the CIA, but I have to submit it to them for censorship first. So I assure you, I could write a 100,000-page book about the CIA, and as long as it was favorable, they wouldn't censor a word.
But you can speak, though.
Well, impromptu speaking is covered, particularly if it's about the subject of my previous book or what I've lectured before. They admitted that it would be very difficult to try to enforce an injunction against interviews and speeches. But if I had written notes for, say, this interview, I would have to submit those notes for censorship.
Well,
long as it's impromptu, though, I'm supposed to be okay.
Well, we have a lot of things here loaded up about the CIA, the stories and information that we've been gathering, waiting for your next trip over to Alternative Views.
Fortunately, I haven't seen their notes that they're going to be working from, so, and they're not under injunction. They don't have to be censored.
Okay. Doug, you have probably the most important one there.
Well, John, to start off, let's look at the CIA under the Reagan administration. What are some of the most significant occurrences vis-a-vis the CIA under Reagan? What has he done in his, terms of his policies that have affected the CIA?
Well, the Reagan election, when he came into office, there was great joy and dancing in the halls of the CIA. They recognized that they would be set back into full-fledged activities, much like they were at the height of their powers in the 50s and 60s. And that euphoria has pretty much continued. I have not been inside the building, obviously, but I have had a couple of conversations with people who were. And without telling me anything of any substance, they did. Their voices were crowing and gloating about how the world was being righted in their mind, and they were out there defending national security and freedom in all kinds of places, as the CIA has done in Chile and Angola and Nicaragua and elsewhere for so many years.
They announced on October the 1st that they're going to literally double the size of their new headquarters, the CIA, which would indicate that they're obviously planning many more activities and an expansion of their entire operations. What are some of the evidence of an expanded CIA under Reagan?
Well, of course, I was kidding. I was up in Washington recently, and I was getting so many invitations to go and lecture that I was kidding and saying that I had something that would go on forever because I'm the last whistleblower, because they've got the court orders and injunctions and the Supreme Court rulings and now the names of agents bill going through, and there won't be, all of which is to say that we probably will never know for sure what they're doing now under Reagan, because they are succeeding in getting in a de facto official secrets acts. So the American public and the victims will never know the true stories of the current activities, like the war in Angola, the pre-Vietnam CIA covert action, the Chile coup, the assassinations. They will be muzzled probably forever, so we won't know for sure. What you hear about are the occasional, it's an organization that will always go around shooting itself in the foot, because it deals with activists who are trained to break the law, who have activist instincts, and they will always be getting themselves in trouble. And what we're really seeing now are gross blunders and gross missteps, and one case where two agents went so far afoul of propriety in the law that it did erupt into the public view.
That's Turpel and Wilson, who covered on 60 Minutes and a PBS documentary.
Are the ones who were helping Libya, right?
Incredible, if you can believe it. Look at the way our president is dealing with the Libyan problem and Gaddafi. Our country so concerned with the terrorism, the hitman team that was supposed to be tracking our president down to kill him. And now we find that two fairly senior CIA officers were out actually training. They had resigned from the CIA, but they were being supported by people who were at the very top of the CIA, who it's not clear, and of course it may never come clear exactly to what degree they were being supported, but they were being met, debriefed, and assisted in some ways by people like Ted Shackley, who was a top CIA. He was chief of the Latin America Division, chief of the Far East Division, and then assistant deputy director of operations. Now, what were these men doing? They were making millions of dollars selling CIA terrorist equipment, expertise, and actually training Libyans, selling this equipment to Libya, and actually training terrorists in the Libyan China Lake terrorist training camp. Now, as the story is being squeezed out in bits and pieces, it's coming out, it's now been documented that there were active duty special forces officers helping them to train terrorists inside Libya. Now, we're talking about up until 78, 79. And there were also CIA active duty personnel at China Lake training terrorists. And this even boggles my mind, having been inside and from what I've seen. But all of the to-do we're making about terrorism, and here we are, here our CIA is delivering technology and actually training Libyan terrorists.
This sort of illustrates your thesis in of Search for Enemies, that the function of the CIA is to cause problems, that makes it possible for military intervention. So that would fit into this sort of scenario that you've drawn.
Indeed, and there's no other real explanation for it. Now, one of the CIA officers who was still in the CIA, he denied at first association with them. They were claiming that he had supported them. He denied it. And then when he had to admit or perjure himself, he had to admit that there was association. He claimed that it was only to keep contact so they could tell him who the terrorists were and what they were doing. Therefore, it was a legitimate CIA enterprise. But then when the Senate tried to squeeze out, and the Justice Department, documentation from the CIA, there was none. And he said that was because it was something that he was keeping in his vest pocket. So either we have a full-fledged CIA operation, or we have an illegal venal, corrupt operation. But either way, there was complicity with these people who were training and making the Libyan terrorists a great deal more effective. Now, mind you, we're talking about millions of dollars. We're talking about the latest in terrorist explosive devices and the way you can make an ashtray into an explosive device, so when a bad guy puts out his, or a good guy for that matter, puts out his cigar, it blows up and kills everyone in the room, you know, this sort of thing.
Well, isn't there, this seems even more incredible from a couple points of view. One is the fact that maybe it's a super Machiavellian thing that the CIA and the FBI need to have terrorists in the world to justify their increased money for appropriations. For instance, when the CIA made their latest report, they indicated that there were 3,336 terrorist attacks during the previous year. Now, Alexander Haig didn't think that was enough, so he sent the report back to the CIA, saying, give me more terrorist attacks, so they upped it to almost 6,000. Then the other aspect of this is that the CIA has historically had a close relationship with the Israeli secret police, the Mossad. And yet the Mossad and the Libyan government and their secret police are mortal enemies, supposedly. So what's going on here?
Well, on the one hand, the CIA purist would argue that we have an intelligence requirement to provide information to our government about terrorists and terrorist organizations about the world. And therefore, the only way you can get this information is to penetrate terrorist organizations, get your people inside so they can tell you what's being done. The other side of that is very much in the direct... And on the first argument, you would try to have contact with Mossad and with the Libyans and with the PLO and with the Red Brigade, anyone you could.
And the KGB.
And the KGB, to gather information about them. That's the purest argument. But how can you explain this provision of shiploads of terrorist equipment to the Libyans and training by active duty special forces and active duty CIA officers? Now that's where it gets so Machiavellian, it blows your mind. And there's no way you can justify delivering the equipment to them in order to gather information about who they are. That's not necessary to gather intelligence. And the only answer is that a little bit of both, that you have an organization that functions in a troubled world. It gets more money and more opportunity. As like you say, Haig wants 6,000 terrorist bombings last year, not 3,000, because it's more dramatic and he can get more mileage out of it. The CIA, by the same token, would like to have a more troubled world because they have more to do. The president and the Congress and the press and everybody are relying on them and giving them their carte blanche more in a troubled world than in a peaceful world. But then the other thing that has raised its head, not the first time, but so ominously in this Wilson-Turpel thing, is individuals doing it for gain, for millions of bucks. Let's face it, someone in the CIA who's commanded wars around the world has sent people off to die, which is the ultimate ego trip for a Pentagon type of person. Is the ultimate power that a human being can have is to send other humans off to die. Not sentence one individual to the gas chamber, but send 5,000 off to die. Well, take someone who's been at the top of the CIA, and he's been doing this secretly and commanding forces in the world, manipulating governments, and then he hits a certain age of maybe 50 or possibly 60 if he goes the whole route, and then he retires on 20,000 a year. And it just, it just isn't comfortable. It doesn't work. Now, some of these people have managed to retire comfortably, like Bill Colby, the former director, and Dick Helms, former director, by becoming agents of foreign governments and so declaring themselves to our Justice Department and getting a salary from the Iranian government or the Japanese government or elsewhere. And people down the line have done the same sort of thing.
Vernon Walters is now doing that, getting hundreds of thousands of dollars consulting for Guatemala, Argentina, Chile, etc.
And Vernon Walters was who?
The deputy director of the CIA.
When I was in, he was the deputy director over me.
Was Nixon's White House man, too.
Yeah. So selling themselves as agents of foreign governments to sell their expertise and contacts that they gathered in their CIA careers. And then you have these guys, it's now surfaced, and it's an obvious, it's a documented fact, have been selling technology, terrorist technology, to the Libyan government. Meanwhile, our government is not moving against the Vernon Walters or the Dick Helmses or the Bill Colbys, who have become agents of foreign governments, but they're suing John Stockwell for writing a book to the American people to tell the truth about what's going on.
And they're trying to pass a bill that would make it illegal for any publication to publish the names of any CIA agents. How does this constitute a threat to freedom of the press?
But mind you, this bill is justified on the basis of the revelation of names. But the bill goes far, far beyond names. It says names of secret agents or the activities of secret agents that could draw attention to them. Now, this means, for example, let's take some things that the CIA has done. Secret agent kicks in your door and rapes your wife. Now, if you went out and wrote an article about that and published it in the paper, both you and the editors of the paper, even if you didn't name him, you just said, Mr. X, working for the CIA, kicked in my door last night and raped my wife, that would be a felony under this law. Now, in the debate in Congress on this law, some of the critics, and there are some, fortunately, but not enough, said, wait a minute, the way I read this proposed bill, if the London Times published an article about a CIA escapade somewhere, the New York Times could not reprint the London Times article without committing a felony. And the sponsors of the bill stood up and roared, that is right. We want to stop all of this talk about the CIA. So what we have here, by the sponsor's own admission, is an official secrets act, and a very strict one, one that will cover anything they want to cover up. They classify it and claim it has to do with secret agents' activities. My book could never be published. The CBS and PBS stories that you mentioned on Turple and Wilson could not be published. It would be a felony. Many of the 60 Minutes shows would be felonies.
So this provides a cover of secrecy for the CIA of the broadest possible sort.
For the first time in our history, freedom of speech has been, is being, now it hasn't passed yet, although the nose count is that it will go sliding right through Congress right now, but for the first time in our history, the secret police of the government are being given legal precedent over freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Now, mind you, they've bludgeoned people before and punished people before, such as myself and Frank Snepp and Phil Agee and Marchetti for criticizing the CIA. But they've done that in civil court, but now it will be a felony to criticize the CIA, to complain about its activities, to expose its corruption. And the record is clear. We're talking about an organization that has been responsible for 300,000 deaths by their own records, by the Senate's own records, 300,000 deaths in the Third World. And that's a modest figure. I gave that figure myself in Senate testimony, and the next morning, Cy Hirsch, I was playing tennis with him, and he said, Stockwell, you're all wet. He said, the figure's over 500,000. You forgot Indonesia. Mm. Now, that's what they've been doing out in the world. Of course, in the mood of these times, there are a lot of Americans who would just as soon melt Africa or Asia or wherever. They really could care less. But they have been doing things in the United States that you would, you know, strange levy kind of things that you would only accredit to the Gestapo or the KGB at their worst.
The mind drug control.
The mind MK Ultra, extensive over years, experimenting with unwitting Americans by dropping them LSD and then filming their activities under the influence of drugs they didn't know they had received.
As well as infiltrating political groups and spying on Americans, which were against the CIA charter. It was not supposed to be domestically involved. And Carter put some guidelines regulating domestic activity of the CIA, and Reagan signed an executive order putting these aside. In effect, unleashing the CIA domestically so that any political group can be, or any individual could be the target of a CIA operation. So this is another threat to our civil liberties here in the country.
For sure, and they're defining who the targets are. They don't have to even go to a judge and say, we think this person's a target. They decide who a target is. And secrecy, as I've said before, and many other people have said, including some leading senators. Secrecy is primarily designed to cover up their misdeeds. Only in the very rare, most internal sensitive cases is secrecy a matter of national security. Yes, diplomacy at a certain point, you need some secrecy to negotiate some things. At a certain point, some military operations have to be secret to work. But, you know, we're talking about a tenth of a percent as compared to everything that is, in fact, being declared secret. What they're trying to cover up is the wars, the killings, the drug experimentation, and the corruption.
There's another bizarre development that seems to be taking place with the CIA under the Reagan administration that I think involves a tremendous expansion of CIA operations and a sort of new field for the CIA to get involved in, and that's the use of businessmen and the Department of Commerce as potential agents. When the Max Hugel affair took place early in the Reagan administration, where this corrupt politician, businessman, friend of Reagan's was put in a position of high power in the CIA, and it turns out that he had all kinds of corrupt business backgrounds and connections. It came out on ABC's Nightline, the Ted Koppel show, in an interview with Bobby Inman, who's deputy director of the CIA, that the reason Max Hugel was brought into the White House was that he had a lot of businessman connections that they would be able to use for operations abroad. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this? Is this a significantly new field for the CIA to be involved in? We know that they've used politicians and diplomats abroad. They've used military abroad. They've even used journalists, that's been revealed.
But well, it's by no means new, but we're talking about a degree. They've done it many, many times, and they've done favors for people all over the world, gathering information for them, you know, a little favor. Yes, we'll find out this for you, whatnot. But it's a question of degree, and in the last few years, including before I got out, there was the government, the U.S. government, was crying for more economic information. And during a lot of the years that I was in, we were not, you know, we would get economic information and pass it on to the ambassador, just stop him in the hall and say, hey, I heard such and so, a deal is going down or something. But what's happening now
is your microphone.
Yes, my microphone is falling off.
The CIA arranged that, I'm sure, John.
Yeah. What's happening now is this corruption that I'm talking about, where a political party, a White House administration, is salting people into top positions in the agency because of their business connections, with the intent of using the organization and its resources to gather intelligence to help the people who are sponsoring that party. This is, of course, the heaviest form of corruption. That position that Hugel was in was deputy director of operations. Now, this is the focal point, the commanding officer of worldwide clandestine operations. Now, you think of the sensitivity and the complexity of covert operations in 150 countries, and this is a job that has to be a pro, and a brilliant pro, and one with driving energy in any sense of the word. Now, mind you, I think that we would probably be better off if the job didn't exist.
Right.
But there's no way it can function with a political appointee in there. And as a matter of fact, there was the part of the reason he was withdrawn was because he was shooting himself in the foot repeatedly several times. There was an incident about Libya, and he was, you know, in this effort to get the CIA moving again, he was approving some exceedingly dangerous operations.
Assassinating Gaddafi, according to a Newsweek story.
He was proposing to assassinate Gaddafi, and there, to my relief, now the Senate Supervisory, the Oversight Committee, which has never succeeded in overseeing the CIA very much, never tried very much, mostly they're encouraging him to go out and do, they did scream at that one and stop him, and it was shortly thereafter that Hugel was removed from office. Now we have the other one at the top. William Casey is another businessman with all kinds of conflicts of interest. He's still holding the portfolio on his own business interests, plus all of his contacts. And he's running the whole intelligence organization right now. And he, again, like the other one, he's shooting himself in the foot about once a week. And lately, 2 days ago, he testified to the Senate and about the Freedom of Information operation. And he was claiming that the CIA couldn't function because they had so many agents wouldn't work with us, but also so many people resigned because of this FOIA. And when the committee, of course, didn't just take his word for it, they said, give us documentation and he couldn't produce any documentation. And finally, he had to admit that not one person had been fired because of, or resigned because of the FOIA. So once again, it's...
John, you were talking about complexity and the Byzantine nature of some of the operations that go on in the in the CIA. Here is one really mind-blowing thing, which was in the August 81 Inquiry, the Libertarian magazine. It talks about an incredible thing. It talks about, first of all, a Florida-based Worldwide Finance Corporation. That's its name. It's a financial conglomerate. And after there were some complaints that led to the doorstep of this thing, a local district attorney started investigating it. There were congressional investigations, and the Justice Department started getting into it. And they found that CIA was involved, Cuban exiles were involved, which isn't really all that unusual because they've been involved for decades down there in the Miami area,
particularly Watergate.
In their operations against Fidel Castro.
Assassination of a president.
Right. But this also gets involved with drug trafficking. And even further than that, they've found that there are relationships with the Russian KGB and the CIA operating together, exchanging information. They found that there have been relationships with Castro's intelligence and the CIA, in which the CIA and Castro decided that they would permit the drug trafficking and helping it along, and then share the help and sharing in the profits so they could finance each other's operations. And the investigations, well, it became so complex that the investigations not only kind of collapsed because they couldn't figure out what the heck was happening, they couldn't unravel it, but also the CIA stepped in and put the kibosh on it. And even the FBI was frustrated because they were involved in it too. This seems like something which you couldn't even dream up if you had a wild imagination, were on some kind of drug trip. Does this sound unreasonable?
No. You know, real life is often stranger than fiction. And I've already run into this in the three books that I've written, with trying to write scenes as exactly as they happened. And then your editors scream at you and you say, but I was there, and that's exactly the way it happened. And they finally say, well, nobody would believe it in print. But yes, I'm quite sure that could happen. I don't know anything about that organization. I haven't followed it. But all of that could easily happen.
Well, the one part of it really sounds true, and that's the permission and expediting of the narcotic traffic for the Cuban exiles so that they can help finance their operations. This sounds very much like what was going on in Vietnam, Southeast Asia.
Sounds like a dream business to get into, because you would be able to do favors for the CIA, the FBI, the KGB, the anti-Castro groups in Florida, and Castro himself, and the drug runners. So you would have all of these organizations paying you off and giving you protection. And that sounds like if you were into corruption and crime, it would be a dream organization.
Well, there was drug trafficking by the CIA during the Vietnam War.
Yes, that's been documented in a book
has been written,
Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, with documents. I mean, documented with government documents they got that conclusively proved and stated that the CIA was... the way it started is they were working with mountain yards who had, up in Thailand mostly, but also in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, who had made their living traditionally by growing heroin and shipping it out. And so they had, the CIA had its air forces flying planes back and forth, and mountain yard allies would be flying down to the capital, and they would want to get on the planes with these suitcases full of heroin. And the CIA, you know, some CIA officers were trying to kick them off, but, you know, these were your allies. You needed them. So the CIA was making decisions to let them ride. And then it got to the point where, and by that I'm making decisions up the chain of command, then it got to the point where they were actually flying special flights, DC-3 flights, to carry the heroin down to the capital as favors for the allies, and also to sort of help finance the whole operation. And then it got to the point where, of course, some of the CIA officers involved were finding ways to use CIA vehicles to fly the stuff back to the States and market it. That's documented.
John,
now, the last leg of that was not, to my knowledge, approved by Washington. Mm-hmm. That was the Maverick, but the rest of it was approved by Washington.
There's another surprising story that came out in the latest Covert Action Information Bulletin, and that is that shortly before his death, Anwar Sadat admitted that Egypt was the conduit for CIA funds to create problems in Afghanistan to aid the rebels, so that the United States was involved early on in the Reagan administration with actually fostering the Afghan rebellion. Have you heard any stories of this nature?
Only what I've read in the press. And, you know, this to me gets into some of the ultimate cynicism. At the same time, one of the more complex decisions of people in the intelligence world is you have the Soviets in Afghanistan, and it's our national policy to regret their presence there. You have rebels who are fighting them, and obviously if they had more arms, they would fight better. But there isn't any chance of our giving them enough support that they could win or even get some momentum going against the Soviets. So we trickle some arms into them so they can escalate the fighting, with the result that a lot more people are killed, and their hopes are raised, and they think they're, in some cases, they're flat told. Of course, the worst case in history of this being done was where the CIA had a huge program to encourage the Hungarian uprising, and they succeeded. The country erupted in a massive uprising. And then when the Soviets put their tanks in, the United States jumped, you know, back across the ocean and got our hands off the place, and the Hungarians, 20,000 Hungarians died.
Well, it happened with the Kurds.
Yeah, it happened with the Kurds.
The Kurds are similar.
The Kurds,
northern,
yes.
Iran.
Yes, many thousands of Kurds died identical when we had satisfied the Shah's little pressure policy initiative against Iraq. And the Shah said, okay, I've got my agreement with Iraq. We jumped back and withdrew our aid from the Kurds, and the Iraqis retaliated and wiped them out.
There's also a report here about biological warfare in Cuba, that certain mosquitoes were introduced, the Cubans claim, by the CIA, that resulted in fever, malaria of all sorts. Have you heard anything about that story?
Yes, the dengue fever. I've certainly heard about it. I've seen written stories about it. I've talked to people about it. The U.S. health, the U.S. medical authorities' line is that it's not technically possible to introduce fever or fever-ridden mosquitoes into Cuba, which is, of course, nonsense. The difficult thing about that is that there's an epidemic of fever in Cuba. The Cubans claim the CIA was behind it. The Cubans could be making it up. They could believe it and be saying it, or it could be completely true. The point, though, is that our government, our CIA, has been guilty of so many things just as nasty as that over the past 30 years, that it's absolutely impossible to deny it.
Plus the fact that they carried out experiments just on this type of thing. They released millions of mosquitoes over at Charleston, South Carolina, to just to observe what would happen. And then apparently it's possible that they put this into effect in Cuba. Although at then, I understand, their main target would have been for the Soviet Union.
Well, they're preparing for the biological warfare wherever. You know, in our concern with nuclear warfare, and I am very concerned, all these atom bombs that we have, and they have, and the macho people, some of them not very bright, beating themselves on the chest and talking, but the chemical and biological bombs that are being amassed may be 100 times as lethal and dangerous and threatening to life on Earth than the nuclear bombs.
Well, the Nazis foresaw this. Rather than put their technology into a nuclear atomic bomb program, they had these chemical warfare.
You remember the CIA had been revealed that they had some poison. They were and the President Nixon had ordered them to get rid of it.
Right.
And then they didn't get rid of it. And Director Colby was called up to explain why they hadn't obeyed a specific presidential order, and with his incredible talent for disarming the Senate, he said, after all, gentlemen, we're not talking about a big warehouse. He said, we're talking about something this size, and he held up a little vial. It was enough poison to kill everyone in a city of 50,000. He held up a little vial this big. He said it was sitting in the back of a safe. And, you know, when you think about that, and when you think that there are warehouses of that poison alone, not to mention the disease and germs and things that can blow this way and that, and there isn't the publicity or the public attention on the ABC arsenals that are being stockpiled.
John, another event we wanted you to comment on, since this is part of your past experience in South Africa or Angola, has to do with the invasion by South African troops in Angola on the pretext that Angola is supporting Namibian rebels and that South Africa has to clean up the operations there and there's Soviet and Cuban troops there that are a threat to South Africa. Would you comment on that? What's the current status? Has South Africa been continuing to harass Angola? Several months back, we reported in detail on what
it's my understanding that South Africa has sort of a permanent military force inside Angola. I don't mean they've built camps, but they are there bombing, raiding, dropping people in on a permanent basis regularly, several hundred miles up inside Angola. What you have in terms of the validity of their claims, you know, Africa was when it was broken into colonies that became countries, they were done without any reference whatsoever to the existing tribes or ethnic groupings. So that in Angola, for example, you have on the north you have the Bakongo as a large original tribe that now overlaps in three countries, and in the north east you have the Balunda, who overlap Angola and into Zaire, and in the south you have the people who are the Namibians, are the people who are of the ethnic grouping with the people in Southwest Africa, but half of the people live inside Angola. Now, it goes without saying that these people, with their ethnic link to those people, are going to be sympathetic, and there's going to be support, and there's going to be traveling back and forth across the border. But what you get into is, of course, modern law. What is South Africa's right to go up and bomb and strafe? South Africa's position, of course, is an outlaw position on Southwest Africa. They're simply refusing to give it its own freedom, its own elections.
Which was mandated by the United Nations.
Long years ago, and they've just absolutely refused to cooperate with this. And to date, no pressure has been brought on them that would really encourage them to set Namibia free, to give it its free election.
Is there any evidence of CIA complicity in this? Frank wanted to ask about the Seychelles Islands. Some of these might be connected.
Well, there was a coup attempt in the Seychelles Islands in which a rugby team, supposedly rugby team, came into the Seychelles Islands, into the airport. And there were also some people that came in earlier in hotels, and they tried to overthrow the government. They had weapons with them. And later it was determined that their base of operations was South Africa. As a matter of fact, they took over an airplane and returned to South Africa. From what your reading of this was there CIA complicity and money involved in that?
Or are the South Africans just becoming like a new CIA and doing their own mischief?
Well, also connected.
In all fairness, and to state the obvious, the CIA is not the only agent of mischief in the world. And there are many other agents of mischief. The CIA is working with many of the others as they do, as they commit their crimes. As far as there any documentation, I wouldn't have the faintest idea. All I know is what I've read in the papers. So you have to speculate. They obviously had at least an atmosphere of encouragement in South Africa, including in the South African government. When they skyjacked the plane and flew back to South Africa, five of them were arrested, and the rest were just turned free immediately. And these five were flown off in a helicopter to someone's estate after posting a minimal bond. Then, because of international pressure, South Africa did go back and arrest 30 more. It's not clear yet what they're going to succeed in and what they're going to try them for, or if they will, in fact, convict them. But I could easily see something like that as more likely developing from South Africans with their very aggressive attitude towards the Seychelles, possibly with CIA foreknowledge, but quite possibly without the CIA knowing about it ahead of time. Had the CIA known about it ahead of time, I'm reasonably sure they would not have complained or protested. That wouldn't be in their nature. But I see no reason to suggest that they set it up. On the other hand, it's quite possible it's the sort of thing that the CIA station chief might very well do, having dinner or going to the office of the boss chief, I think they call it something else now, the South African Security Force, and saying, you know, you big talk. What are you going to do about the Seychelles? Why don't you fly some people up there and take the place and turn it in the right direction? And then the South African calling in a couple of rugby players or former mercenaries and saying, you know, it would be easy. Here's what you would have to do. And giving them some advice and guiding and setting it in motion, maybe some money.
Right. I might note to our audience that it's quite remarkable that John Stockwell in the last few years has begun this second career as a novelist. As you might know, it's very difficult to get a book published, much less a novel these days. And John's first novel was immediately picked up by William Morrow, which is one of the best New York publishers and has just come out. So we congratulate you, John, on your new career and wish you all the best, but we still want you to come back and talk to us about the CIA and many other things on alternative views.
Remember, I'm the last whistleblower. I'll never be dated.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Since we videotaped our interview with John Stockwell on recent CIA activities, a conference has taken place in the Boston area on reviving the CIA. Over a 10-day period, more than 1,000 people attended, and quite a few scholars and anti-CIA activists provided an update on CIA activity. There were two reports in that conference that we didn't touch on in our discussion with John. First of all, Saul Landau of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., reported that he had information that the Reagan administration had notified Congress in mid-December that the CIA was coordinating border raids from Honduras into Nicaragua and was also using a clandestine radio station to send false rumors to the Mosquito Indians in eastern Nicaragua that the Sandinistas intended to exterminate them in an attempt to get these Indians to have an uprising against the Nicaraguan government. There was also a report in the conference by a Vietnamese scholar, Ngo Vinh Long, that during the CIA operations in Vietnam, they recruited agents who are still active in Vietnam, carrying on CIA operations against the Vietnamese people, and also indicated that certain right-wing Vietnamese are now being paid by the CIA to spy on the Vietnamese who have come to settle in this country, and that in some cases, certain of these right-wing Vietnamese have taken retaliatory actions against left-wing members of the Vietnamese community living in America, indicating that there are still Vietnamese intelligent agents and politics going on in this country.
Now we jump from 1981 to 1986.
Well, 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 guess what? It looks like old Danilov might have been doing some business with the CIA after all. Of course, not admitted until he got back into the United States, and then not even publicized much by the regular media. But it seems that 2 days after Danilov left the Soviet Union, the U.S. officials changed their story about his contacts with the CIA back in 1985. So it raises some questions about how innocent the man was. Maybe he was innocent, but maybe he was just used. Well, we'll see. Danilov confirmed some of these allegations himself at an October 13th issue of U.S. News and World Report, where he said he was approached by a Father Roman, who was supposedly a priest, and he was sought out by him and was given some information. Well, Long Island newspaper Newsday correspondent Roy Gutman made an investigation into this, and he reported that this Father Roman promised to give Danilov some material on religious subjects. And he asked Danilov to take the material to the U.S. Embassy, which Danilov did. But there were some other envelopes, including one addressed to CIA Director William Casey, and that was given to the CIA station chief. all from this one package from Father Roman. Now, in one letter was a reference to rockets and other military subjects, according to the Newsday Washington reporter. And one embassy asked Danilov how to get in touch with Roman, and he provided information on how to do it. So in a very unusual move, and one administration official is very amateurish, a CIA man actually called this Father Roman on the phone and said, yeah, we got the packet. And then he later sent Roman a note saying that he had received the package from the journalist friend, just confirming his telephone conversation. So as a result of all these events, the U.S. was eager to have Danilov freed because of the CIA mishandling of this whole business. So it's a question whether Danilov was really involved himself or whether he was just inadvertently used. But nonetheless, well, what's the final analysis? Ellen Ray, who contributes a lot to the Covert Action Information Bulletin and is a co-director of the Institute for Media Analysis, said in answer to the question, was Danilov spying? He said, well, he admits to delivering documents to the embassy, discussing them with CIA agents, and giving them information about the man who gave them to him, which the CIA then used to contact the man. And she said, you don't have to be on the CIA's payroll to commit espionage.
And it might at least have led the Soviet Union to believe that Danilov was a spy.
And who knows, maybe the guy was set up by the KGB.
Right. And indeed a faction of the KGB that was opposed to Gorbachev's summit with the U.S. This is all lost in murky U.S.-Soviet relations. But what's most striking to me about the Danilov-Zakharov affair is that the U.S. media almost unanimously assumed that Danilov was an innocent journalist who is either set up by the CIA or a victim of KGB repression, whereas Zakharov was supposedly a Soviet spy who was caught red-handed and was guilty without any question at all. Well, an article in October 1st in these Times raises some question about this and indicates that the Zakharov case has all the earmarks of an FBI sting parallel to the Abscam case, where the FBI stung certain congressmen by tempting them with certain lucrative payoffs from different supposed Arabs who are really FBI agents in disguise. Well, to put the Zakharov case in perspective in these Times argues, you have to go back to the early days of the Reagan administration when Jean Kirkpatrick was the head of the U.S. delegation to the United Nations and was claiming that the U.N. was a hotbed of third world radicalism and that the U.N. was a nest of Soviet spies. The problem was that Jean Kirkpatrick didn't have any evidence that any Soviet UN officials were actually engaged in espionage for the Soviet Union and were therefore looking very closely at the Soviet UN employees to see if they could find some evidence of any kind of spying for the Soviet Union whatsoever. The story then jumps to 1983 when a computer major at Queens College got a call from a UN official asking him if he would do some work accessing some data networks for him to get some information on technology and military affairs. The computer major John had put up an advertisement saying that he was willing to do database searches for people, and Zakharov had seen the advertisement and contacted him. And then supposedly John went to the FBI and said that he was approached by a Soviet agent or a Soviet UN official who was going to ask him to do some computer searches, and from thereafter the FBI was monitoring the situation very closely. What Zakharov was doing at this time from 1983 to 1985 was perfectly legal. He was at that time in the UN Center for Science and Technology, where he was responsible for collecting and appraising information on scientific developments to give to third world countries, so it was logical that he would look for some database searches. In 1985, however, John was given a job with a Queens firm that was engaged in manufacture of unclassified precision parts for military equipment. It was suggested in these Times article that John might have been given this job to try to set up
Zakharov to tempt him with some military information and thus be able to arrest him as a spy. And now it's not clear who to believe. Zakharov admitted that he'd worked with John for a couple years and said that he continued to get information from John from this military company that he worked for in Queens, but claimed that this was all unclassified data. John, however, and the FBI confirms this, claims that Zakharov offered to do a 10-year contract with John to pay him for unclassified military information, and it was at this point that he was arrested and was accused of being a spy. And then, of course, a week later, shortly thereafter, the Soviets pinched Danilov. In any case, the question is, why would the U.S. arrest Zakharov in any case, since there was no information that he had anything that was of value, any military secrets, and this became a major media blitz against the Soviet Union and imperiled the summit. The hypothesis of the In These Times reporter is that there might have been people in the Reagan administration who were trying to sabotage the summit between Reagan and Gorbachev, and this was one way to do it.
It might have been even more complex than that. I think it was in The Nation. I forgot to bring that article with me, but there was a reporter analysis of it, speculating on perhaps it might have been the Danilov affair set up by the KGB or the military-industrial complex of the Soviet Union itself, because we know the Soviet Union is not a monolith, and there are hawks within the Politburo and etc. Who would not like to see all these great reductions in armaments that the secretary is wanting to offer. So it could be that they set up Danilov knowing that the United States would take the bait and create a lot of hate and discontent, and then they wouldn't be able to get this agreement. And so the hawks in the Soviet Union won, as well as in the United States.
Right. Yeah, and what's striking is the way that the media in the United States just presumed that Danilov was innocent and Zakharov was guilty and didn't do any in-depth investigation of either of these fellows, or they didn't release any of the information that cast shadows on the official report in the left-wing newspapers. You didn't see any of this in Time, Newsweek, the networks, or any of the major newspapers.
That's why you got to read the alternative press in order to find out what's happening. That's Alternative Views for this evening. We'd like to thank Austin Community Television, ACTV, for the use of their equipment. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713.